about language and using it to help us and using it to hinder us. And I thought I would talk tonight about some of the ways in which I've seen use language for myself, and I've seen other people use language so that it can create a heaven or a hell, depending on how one uses it. And I thought I'd also use lots of different poems from different poets, mystics, writers that illustrate what I think are beautiful ways to use language, ways that can be very liberating. One of the I think of language having sort of been involved in studying it and working with it as a kind of investigation for the last few years. I think of language kind of as a magical act, as a conjuring magical wand at times. That it's just with a few words, it's so easy to create a sense of a particular way of looking at the world. And with a few other words, it's so easy to create another way of looking. There's one little Zen poem, a bunch of Zen poems that illustrate these so succinctly. One poem that says, "In summer, everywhere is summer. In winter, everywhere is winter." Just like that. You could probably, the modern meditation retreat one would be, "In pain, everything is pain. In pleasure, everything is pleasure." But just if you ever notice, you know, just that single word, pain, and suddenly you're busy thinking, this is pain, and when will it end, and why am I here, and what's going on, and what is this about? And in pleasure, I just want this to keep going on forever, don't end, this is such a great sitting, my meditation is so clear, whatever it is. So just a word can send us off in one direction or send us off in another. I think that's one of the magical aspects of language. So easy to just create a world with words. Another aspect of language that I think is very revealing too is the illusion that words give us in their own particular way. We could call it an illusion, or perhaps a sense of incompleteness is a better word. That somehow when I give a name to something, it seems as if I've actually picked out something that's discrete and separate. Because of the way words work, it seems as if when I give a name to something that it's very distinct from everything else. For example, like when I say meditation bench, it seems like it's a separate object. Everybody kind of looks at it, knows what a meditation bench is, and I don't have any problem with that. But really that's kind of deceptive, because in order for you to know what a meditation bench is, you have to know what meditation is, you have to know what sitting is, you have to know what... Let's see, what else do you have to know? You have to know that this is not the rug, it's not the wall. You have to know a lot of other things. So basically, one of the deceptions, perhaps, of the incompleteness of words is that it seems as if when I say a word, that gives that appearance of separation, or that whatever I'm talking about is separate from everything else and can exist independently of everything else. And if you just look around the room, and you just look within your own field of vision, does anything really look separate from anything else? If you're just looking around the room right now, or if you're just sitting there with your eyes shut and feeling the sensations, you know, where does you end and where does something else begin? or if you're just looking around the room, seeing the outlines of everything, you notice that I'm distinct from the wall because of this outline. There's white here, there's blue here, there's a juxtaposition. There's one thing against another. There's a pattern. So it's not that I'm separate. It's like my presence is defined by something else. One word is defined by another word. So there's this constant process of defining one thing in terms of something else. And in Buddhism, this is called dependent origination. One thing is defined by something else. One thing takes on its existence or its meaning in relationship to something else. And while I think that can be very apparent when you just look around, you see, yeah, everything is defined by everything else. And for me to notice this mat, I notice the rug, or I notice the wall. For me to notice a person, I notice what's behind the person, or the color of their clothes, or perhaps even their name. Something is always defining something else. But I think the conjuring act, or the trick in language, is to lead you to believe that when you say a word, it really defines something completely in isolation. And you forget this relationship. You forget that something is always being defined by something else. Very subtle little switch, yet very, very amazing how we start to think then in terms of ourselves or the world made up of all these separate little objects. Kind of seems that way. Not realizing that everything is defined by everything else. Everything is related to everything else. Everything takes on its own definition in relationship to something else. There's another good Zen poem about this. The bell doesn't ring, nor does the stick. The between is ringing. So is that between that we forget about? We forget about the betweenness that defines us, in a sense. And this forgetting of this between, the relationship, the relating of one thing to another thing to have some kind of existence or form or meaning, goes very deep. It goes deep in the sense that we're so used to thinking of things being separate from the language that we use, the words, that perhaps one of the biggest ones that we biggest ways of forgetting is that we tend to think of ourselves as being separate and unrelated to everything else. Me is probably one of the most forgotten objects of all, that it seems as if I really am separate. I tend to think of myself as some kind of entity that's really apart from everything else. And just use that word me a lot, I a lot, and I'm convinced that I is really somehow separate. But if you examine your, so-called your experience, in what way are you separate from anything? And really simply, I mean, for one thing, you're constantly breathing the air. You wouldn't exist for, you know, not more than a couple minutes without it. So you're thoroughly dependent on the air. In that way, you're thoroughly dependent on the plant, because without the plant, there's no oxygen. Without the oxygen, there's no us. So you and the tree are really having a very close relationship most of the time. You know, if you look around, even your body is just completely related to everything else in the same way that, you know, the rug and the cushion and the microphone, it's all related, especially in your field of vision. Hearing these sounds, you know, who's hearing the sound? Well, is it my sound or is it your sound? I mean, which sound is it? You know, is that over here, over there? Is it in you, outside of you? when you have your eyes shut and you're just listening, what is it? But we nevertheless come back to this hypnotic trance that each day when we're out in the world of doing whatever it is we do, our work, our relationships, everyone talking to each other, constantly enrolling each other in this idea that, yes, you really are separate, and I'm over here and you're over there. Not even realizing that for me to be me, you're going to be you. I define me over against you. Constantly going on in language. And so much of a sense of suffering comes out of that, because when you're feeling separate, when you're feeling like you're a self that's disconnected in this way from everything else, then you want to connect to everything else. And all kinds of attempts to connect to everything else are made through striving, through attempting to, for example, achieve in some way, that to achieve status or to achieve acknowledgement in some way, forgetting that there is this very simple connection that's always going on. We already are very connected to everything else. We already are in relationship to everything else. But it's like a pervasive game. I mean, just notice when you start talking again. Fortunately, you don't have to do that a lot of the time, but just notice once you start talking again how quickly that trance sets in. Oh, you're over there, I'm over here. We're separate from each other. So that's one of the, I call it a liability of language, the way we use it, that we become very convinced that everything is separate from everything else. And the outgrowth of that kind of belief can be seen in very major ways. If we're separate from our environment, then we can trash it. That's just, we don't have to relate to it. If we're separate from other species, from other animals, who cares if they become extinct? Just part of being who I am, separate. And I guess one of the ways in which we need to work with this, one of the things to realize is that language has its place because it is useful and we do function in the world using it. It's just that we get enrolled in this one particular way of understanding it, which is to think of words as indicating things that are separate. But then there are many kinds of poetry that remind us that that's not necessarily the case. That language can be used to also remind us that the words are really reflections of each other. That you can't have black without white. You can't have happy without sad. You can't have up without down or me without you. That for everything we think, every way we think, there's something that's a complement to it. And this is just something, again, we forget so readily. It seems as if once you have happy, it really is separate from sad. We divorce those two from each other and want to keep them apart. So we have, the game of life versus death. We have a game of black versus white. We have all these divisions that we make, and then believe that the things that are these divisions really are separate. That hot is truly different from cold in some fundamental way. Not realizing that the two terms go together. You'd never know what hot was if you didn't know what cold was. So there are many kinds of poems that remind us about this. And I would say, the degree to which you can realize that black goes with white and me goes with you and happy goes with sad, pleasant with unpleasant, very liberating, very liberating. Because then you don't try to just have one side of the experience. I don't know if any of you noticed or just in the sitting quietly or being with yourself, the one-sidedness that tends to come out, where you just tend to want to have one kind of experience over against its opposite, that division that gets made. I'd much rather have this very pleasant, clear feeling as I'm sitting than being completely confused, not knowing what's going on, lost. So, clarity versus unclarity. However, it doesn't work that way. Because if you're going to have one, you've got to have the other. As soon as you recognize one, the other is not far behind, since they go together. One of the ways to put this, so many poems here, let me see. Your job itself is the sound of one hand clapping. No use using both hands. Had you done a good job clapping with two hands, no need then to hear the sound of one. Very Zen. Some say things exist, others say not. Which view is true? It's like the difference in names, water and ice. This is kind of nice. In hell, too, is there the shade of a tree? A summer afternoon. Good and bad, or the reflections in the mirror. Watch them closely and you know they're nothing but yourself. So there's a sense of one thing depending on the next. And then there's a sense of somehow being able to have an understanding that goes beyond that. It somehow embraces both of these, the yes and the no, good and the bad. There's a way in which we can understand that opens the door, so to speak. Before I get into that, there's another way, and one other way in which I think is helpful is another way in which to realize, to apply this idea of words, giving you the sense that things are separate or discrete. And actually, I was realizing this from some of the groups we've been doing, having conversations. Another really popular view I see is that it seems to us sometimes that our emotions are also some kind of separate thing within us, just like our thoughts seem to be separate things within us, our emotions too. And I noticed this for myself too. There's a sense that some feeling I have, like anger or like love, almost has the sense of being a quantity, so that, you know, I need to have more love, or I need to give some of it to you, or you should give some of it to me, or I need to let my anger out. What is that? How is that word taking on, making it seem like that what's happening within us is some kind of thing or fluid or something like that? It's another example. And I see that a lot in terms of conflicts between people, especially in terms of people wanting more love or less love from each other, as if it's something you could actually dish out. There's a great poem by Rumi, hearing this, that I think redefines whole understanding of love in this way. He says, "The minute I heard my first love story, I started looking for you, not knowing how blind that was. Lovers don't finally meet somewhere, they're in each other all along." That the whole sense of being in love is recognizing that the other person is actually the flip side of you. Flip side of the coin. So it's sort of playing this game of opposites. And I thought it might be nice also to read some poems which express the ways in which people go beyond the opposites, because they give you a feeling of what it's like to take both sides of any set of words and realize that they go together. And once you realize that, then what? What happens past that? There's a couple of poems by Rumi that are really beautiful, saying, "We have this way of talking, and we have another. We have one way of talking, we have another way of talking. Apart from what we wish and what we may fear may happen, we are alive with other life, as clear stones take form in the mountain." Another one, he says, "Out beyond ideas of wrong and right, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the heart lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense." It's a kind of curious contradiction. There's some kind of wisdom that's being pointed to, in which somehow, out beyond what we say, out beyond the ideas of right and wrong, or between the ideas of this and that, there's a kind of understanding which is very difficult to talk about, and yet still trying to talk about it. And yet still people still writing poems about it. And yet we keep talking and talking anyway. And sometimes we stop, sometimes we start. I don't think actually that kind of wisdom is diminished by language either. I think it's just a question of realizing this peculiar kind of liability where we just tend to isolate with words, or we tend to leave out one side. There's the good, there's bad, there's this and that, that they go together. There's another way in which this idea of the limitations of talking is addressed by another poet, Walt Whitman. Has a beautiful thing to say. He says, "I've heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end. But I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now. There never will be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. To elaborate is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. Sure as the most certain sure, plumb in the upright, well entreated, braced in the beams, stout as a horse, affectionate, haughty, electrical, I am this mystery, here we stand. Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul." Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. It's a wonderful statement. He also says, "I swear I see what is better than to tell the best. It's always to leave the best untold. When I undertake to tell the best, I find I cannot. My tongue is ineffectual on its pivot. My breath will not be obedient to its organs. I become a dumb man. The best of the earth cannot be told anyhow, all or any. His death." A marvelous, expansive point of view. All or any is best. be able to say that. It also says, I know I have the best of space and time and was never measured and never will be measured. He's not in a box. Doesn't come in a box. And then, in terms of just actually expressing, this is so beautiful too. Doesn't, you know, you think you might, this might stop you realizing that rather leave the best untold, but still, you know, he's written this book of 300 pages of nothing but poems all the way through until he died. So I guess he just kept saying what he thought was best at the time, realizing it would come out later with something else. And he says in one of his poems, I lie abstracted and hear beautiful tales of things and the reasons of things. They are so beautiful, I nudge myself to listen. I cannot say to any person what I hear. I cannot say it to myself. It is very wonderful. Cannot say it to myself. It's sort of the sense, I think in one of the groups we were touching on it today too, of the sense of knowing who you are in some way. We're so pressed to know who we are. We're so rounded up by all the roles in which we live out to get a sense of who or what we are. I am now this. I am now that. I am pursuing this goal. I am pursuing that goal. I am having a meaningful life. I am having an unmeaningful life. I am happy. I am sad. I am this. I am that. On and on and on. On and on and on. And how difficult it can be sometimes to admit, I don't really know who I am. I don't know who I am. Just so difficult to say. I mean, you know, when was the last time you said that to somebody? Somebody said, are you going to do... And you said, I don't really know. Don't know who I am. Don't know who I am. This is a poem by Rumi that kind of touches on this. Do you think I know what I'm doing? That for one breath or half breath, I belong to myself. As much as a pen knows what it's writing, or the ball can guess where it's going next. What a relief reading that poem. I mean, what a relief not knowing who you are. I would think. I kind of find it a burden. I kind of find it a burden having to know who I am and having to know what I'm going to do next. Believing that that's knowable. Alan Watts says, I do not believe there is anything special which I am supposed to be by the standards of some outside metaphysical authority, whether Freud or Jesus or even Lao Tzu. D.T. Suzuki, the Zen teacher, would sometimes sign himself as Bunjinin, which means no special person. And when the Emperor Wu asked Bodhidharma, who are you? He answered, I don't know. Neither do I, for it's impossible to bring vision into clear and objective focus on itself. You can't see yourself. You just can't see yourself. Just try, and somewhere along the way, you will discover that the only real you is the shifting and momentary totality of everything you see and feel within and without. I do not bother, then, with the vicious circle of discovering my real personality, or make any special attempt to act naturally. I just put on whatever personal style seems appropriate to the circumstances or entertaining to myself or to others. Others may see a consistent personality underlying all these acts, but this must surely be their projection on my blot, my Rorschach blot. And just as this, he's writing his autobiography, is the projection all the same. All interesting descriptions of human beings are poetic, imaginative, dramatic, and fantastic, whereas all attempts at valid description are myopic and dull. That's why writing biography is an art, not a science. But continuing that theme of just not knowing who we are, I'm kind of getting excited about that. So, it's kind of strange not knowing who you are. It's kind of ignorance in a way about yourself. When everything in society all around you is conspiring to have you know it's precisely that. To have you be somebody. Certainly for you to know who you are, to know what you are, to know where you are. It's another poem by Rumi. Mysteries are not to be solved. The eye goes blind when it only wants to see why. Somehow we're who we are, what we are, you know, it's not quite sayable, except, I guess, as some kind of poetic expression, perhaps, as some kind of groan or moan or grunt, as some words that are coming out right now as I'm talking, maybe as some words that you're hearing as you're listening, or maybe as the sound of the breeze. I always get into this place giving some kind of talk. I have no idea what I'm going to say. Who would have ever thought it would amount to this? Read another poem. I love poems. They kind of say it as well as anything else. Here's the poem. So, you know, question, what does it mean to be awake? People talk about being awake. I think, you know, personally, a good deal of part of being awake is definitely being asleep. You really couldn't know what being awake was without being asleep. Certainly couldn't know what being free was without being enslaved. Certainly couldn't know what you are without knowing what you are not. So it's a kind of strange position we're in, because we talk about liberation or talk about freedom, talk about seeing things clearly. Well, because we're playing this game of language, the only way I think to see things clearly is definitely not to see things clearly. The only way to find out what a sense of freedom is to certainly experience what not being free is. If you want to find out what no self is, definitely we'll find out what yourself is. They all go hand in hand. It's part of the game of talking. And that's kind of a paradoxical way of talking. I mean, that's kind of what so many teachers or so many teachings say, you know, the experience. A combination of the two, it seems so paradoxical. But, you know, just remember, it's only paradoxical because that's the way we talk. That's the language of how we're talking. If you want to find out what this lack of self is, one of the ways you find out is all of the things that you think are self. But there is some sense of being awake in the midst of this. There's some sense of waking up and somehow seeing or feeling or perceiving or being that is taking these two sides into account. And another poem by Rumi gives a feeling of this. It says, "Spring and everything outside is growing, even the tall cypress tree. We must not leave this place. Around the lip of the cup we share these words, my life is not mine." If someone were to play music, it would have to be very sweet. We're drinking wine, but not through lips. We're sleeping it off, but not in bed. Rub the cup across your forehead. The day, this day, is outside living and dying. Give up wanting what other people have. That way you're safe. Where can I be safe, you ask? This is not a day for asking questions, not a day on any calendar. This day is conscious of itself. This day is a lover, bred in gentleness, more manifest than saying can say. Thoughts take form with words, but this daylight is beyond and before thinking and imagining. Those two, they are so thirsty, but this gives smoothness to water. Thinking and imagining, their mouths are dry and they are tired. And the rest of this poem is too blurry for them to read. Too blurry for them to read. Sometimes I think that way about us humans, about myself, about you. We're probably much too blurry to read. In fact, it's probably in that blurriness that something of this awakening comes through. It's probably in the midst of that blurriness that we maybe start to read ourselves in a different way. I could keep actually going on reading these poems. Maybe I'll read a few more. And yes, this is nice. Talking about language again, another Rumi poem. Language is a tailor's shop where nothing fits. They've cut and sewn a gown to fit the figure of the buyer, but the gown is too long and the buyer's too short. Bring a taller person. The tape measure is a bowstring as long as from here to the moon. Bring someone that tall. Now I'll be quiet and let silence separate what is true from what are lies, as threshing does. Well, I think I'll read two more things and kind of put that's kind of the message for the time being. I guess the message being part of the way I'm asking you to kind of be with language or play with language is to realize that whatever you're saying is probably one half of what you're saying, and that there's another half coming along. And does that really finish the description anyway? Whatever you're thinking, whatever you're saying, wherever you think you are, is it really that complete? Here's something again by Alan Watts. He describes it so well. He's saying, differences, borders, lines, surfaces, boundaries, all different kinds of languages, distinctions, do not really divide things from each other at all. They join them together because all boundaries are held in common. When you understand this, you see that the sense of being me is exactly the same sensation as being one with the whole cosmos. You do not need to go through some other weird, different kind of experience to feel in total connection with everything. Once you get the clue, you see that the sense of unity is inseparable from the sense of difference. The secret is that what is other eventually turns out to be you. That is the element of surprise in life, to find that the thing that is most alien to you is actually you. If you go out at night and look at the stars, you will realize that they are millions and millions and billions of miles away, vast configurations in space. And you can lie back and look at that and say, wow, surely I hardly matter. I am just this tiny little peekaboo on this weird spot of dust called Earth. And all that out there was going on billions of years before I was born and will still go on billions of years after I die. Nothing may seem stranger to you than that, more different from you. But there comes a point when you will say, why, that's me. And when you know that, you know you never die. And you surely know that you never know who you are either. So, that's it. Any questions? Fine. Any comments? Fine. Now, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to continue talking. Say something.
But, well, I wanted to mention, I went to a talk at Sharpham a few months ago. It was about the Hopi people and their use of language. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember it all, but it sounded very, very interesting. Mm. But they don't have nouns. They only have words, so, what do we call this? Meditation, benching.
Benching, right.
At the moment, this is benching.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I once was teaching a class in which there was a Hopi in it, and we were talking about, somehow we got to talking about the sheep up in the pasture, and he said, oh, well, we never think of it as sheep, you know, little sheep, individual sheep in the pasture. We mostly think of it as sheeping. You know, and we don't really have a lot of words for that. We didn't really talk about peopling. You know, you don't sit there going, eyeing. And, you know, we do have a few words that are like that, like housing. Right? But we really lack, because we divide things into nouns and then verbs and then try to make a connection between the two. You know, but really, when you just kind of inspect what's happening, you're basically just being, doing, eyeing, ising, thising, and thatting. It's very verb. Yeah, it's a verb. If you can think of yourself as a verb, not bad. Not bad.
I have a comment. I'm a bit frightened tonight because I'm not quite sure. But I did notice all the way through that all your readings were written by men. With this experience, going through it here, it seemed like a lot of this tripping ourselves up on language during that week just didn't seem relevant to me. I don't know if there's anything in there.
That there might be, you mean, some way in which women don't have the same kind of conditioning in relationship to language, that it's not as much of a problem.
Or maybe it's a different kind of problem.
Or a different kind. Yeah. That could be. Actually, I realized that, you know, that these were a lot of male poets. Need to bring in the women poets next time, too. Actually was, sure, yeah, that's a good point. And there certainly are plenty of them to bring in.
Maybe one, then woman poet.
Oh, I mean, the poet I was thinking of is just a contemporary American poet.
Well, is it the male macho you've written anyway from the past?
Seems that a lot of those male poets do seem to get recorded over the women ones. Yeah, I mean, that could be a real deficit in Buddhism. I think it is. I think a lot of women are pointing that out now. That it's been very male-dominated in a certain sense. Yeah. But, I mean, there are a lot of women poets who express beautifully.